From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll have interviews with some of our favorite Wisconsin authors, starting with a book about the state's early gay history. Then Matthew Prigge discusses his book on Milwaukee's Newhall House Fire, one of the deadliest hotel fires in U.S. history.
I don't imagine you could have more perfectly designed a system to destroy this building than this elevator shaft that within a few minutes delivered the fire to every floor of the house and the roof.
And it wasn't so long ago that many Americans were a meal or two away from starvation, which partly explains our embrace of processed and shelf-stable foods.
That ability to preserve food and then fortify it and inoculate it with antibacterials and vitamins, you know, make it more than what it actually is. When it first started, it really served a great purpose and helped people.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. All places around the globe have a gay history, but it's still a largely untold one, particularly in Wisconsin. The national narrative of gay history often involves events that took place on the coasts, the most recognizable one being Stonewall. But according to scholar and activist Dick Wagner, there was a pre-Stonewall liberation for gays and lesbians in Wisconsin. His book, We've Been Here All Along, examines Wisconsin's gay history from 1895 to 1969. From press coverage of Oscar Wilde's trial, anti-vice crusades, to post-war medical labeling of homosexuality as an illness, Wagner dives deep to find the legacy and resilience of early gay Wisconsinites and their influence on the evolution of the state. He joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski by phone from his home in Madison in September and began by explaining why the early gay history of Wisconsin was worth his in-depth examination.
What's noteworthy to me is that before Stonewall, you had gays and lesbians in Wisconsin figuring out their identities. They were forming networks of support, which basically is the same liberation that starts to occur greatly after Stonewall. And so you have a pre-Stonewall liberation occurring that is hardly known by folks either in the state or even beyond the state's boundaries.
Right. People don't often think about gay history, especially in the Midwest, much less what occurred on the various coasts in the United States.
Right, right. So, you know, the title We've Been Here All Along is a little stab at, you know, like gay history began before Stonewall, and gay history was not all on the East Coast with Stonewall riots in New York, nor all on the West Coast with the early homophile organizations that were founded out there.
And how did Wisconsin's climate fare compared to other states across the U.S.? I mean, in general, places were very homophobic, especially in early history and especially post-World War II. But what was Wisconsin like?
Well, Wisconsin had the whole apparatus of homophobia. It had legal prohibitions. It had police enforcement. It had the courts opining about how horrible the crime of sodomy was. And then after World War II, it had the whole medical apparatus of sickness that was applied. So Wisconsin had the whole basis of homophobia, which makes the remarkable brave stories of men and women who sorted out their lives positively even more remarkable.
Right. And with researching this book extensively, you have great primary documents, photos. What challenges did you face when collecting your research, and what sources did you end up going to back and back again?
I came across surprising resources, and learning how to interpret them, knowing the general writing about gay and lesbian history nationwide, gave me sort of frameworks to go look. The book by Alan Burby about coming out under fire had just one footnote about a Truax study in it. That was done by a professor at the University of Wisconsin Medical School and a psychiatrist who was at the Truax Army Air Force Base. And so I actually dug out the study, and the study, while it was about endocrine theories of homosexuality, which was not proved by the study, nevertheless took some life histories of the gay men who were in the study. And one of the just sort of astounding things was that they all rejected the sickness description that had been applied for the medical screening of homosexuals out from World War II. And then there was this throwaway line that the researchers listed that four of them were members of a gay organization, and this was in 1945 here in Madison, Wisconsin. So that just sort of blew my mind that when you start tracking from sources that, you know, there's this sort of total resistance to the self-imposed homophobia that they're supposed to internalize.
And I imagine you needed to pay special attention to language, whether it was finding primary documents that were within gay groups in Madison and beyond. And the nature of your research with researching people during a period where evidence could be used against them. So finding those subtleties. So what did you find that were key instances or words to look out for? Or what did you learn to like filter through in your mind?
Well, some of the visible folks were Bob Neal and Edgar Hellam in Mineral Point, Wisconsin. In the 1930s, the two of them bought these little Cornish cottages and started to fix them up and run an antique shop and then eventually sort of a Cornish meal operation out of these old homes. And there were lots of descriptions about them, and they talked about the partners. They didn't use a qualifier like business partners. But they also talked about artistic and about young men, even though they were middle-aged in terms of the lifespan of the period. So clearly these code words were being used to describe them. And you also get some other words that are less coded, like fairy or pixies or other things like that, that get applied to men in the pre-World War II period. So if you know what to look for, you can find the stuff.
With the structure of homophobia, the press certainly played a role in that. And I found it fascinating, you know, the power of language, whether that be in suppressing representation of people or recognition, even though most of the time it was negative, from where you start the book with Oscar Wilde's trial being covered in Wisconsin to beyond. With you as a researcher and a writer, how did you reflect upon use of language throughout all of the research you were doing?
I mean, it was interesting to see how people changed sort of positions. In the Vice study of the 1913-14 period, progressive sociologists roundly condemned permitting vice to be visible or seen in the communities. And then you had progressive sociologists in the 1930s beginning to talk about homosexuality not as a crime, but as a condition of people, and so they were exploring new theories, and the same with the studies right at the end of the war and following, is that, you know, they were showing that gay men and lesbians had actually served in the military services, even though the military had tried to screen them out. So the whole question about whether gay men and women could be patriotic or not, this whole part of that McCarthy period of the Lavender Scare. And in Wisconsin, there was resistance to that, as well as sort of admittedly hiding as well.
Right. And I did want to touch upon that with Senator Joe McCarthy being one of Wisconsin's you know, big historical figures. You found he was prosecuting gays more than communists, yet that wasn't getting as much attention in the press. You know, we think of McCarthyism, we think of communism being rooted out by any means possible. Right. So what was this other side to it?
Well, McCarthy, in his own words, was quite against commies and queers. And one of the Republican bosses in the state urged the Republicans nationally to pick up the McCarthy charges because he was having an effect against homosexuals in government. So the whole apparatus, which was focused about trying to rid homosexuals out of government service, comes in with actually the Eisenhower administration. Previously, homosexuals might have been judged as a security risk on an individual basis, but with the McCarthy period and the Eisenhower executive order, it was a whole class of people just by their status that was considered a security risk. So you know, Wisconsin went through that as well. There were folks at Truax who were sort of bopped out of the military services. But many more nevertheless served and resisted that.
Another thing to touch upon that I feel is important is also along Wisconsin institutions, UW-Wisconsin's treatment of gay students. You know, we here at Milwaukee's NPR, we're under UW-Milwaukee, which is, of course, part of the bigger UW system.
Right.
So could you touch upon how the gay students were treated at UW-Wisconsin-Madison in particular when it comes to regards of therapeutic discipline and the 1962 purge? I feel like when people think of our college institutions, this is not touched upon a whole lot.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
The Madison campus initiated what they called, as you said, therapeutic discipline, where if someone was found out to be homosexual, and it was all men, that they were sent to psychiatrists because they were presumed to be sick and that maybe they could be adjusted or cured. Some of them played along with that because they wanted to get readmitted back into the university. Others simply said, no, I'm not sick. I don't want to go to the psychiatrist. So, but in those cases, they often lost financial support or were denied access to the School of Medicine or the College of Education. Because it wasn't thought those were appropriate roles for homosexuals to fill. There had been some earlier cases arising in Milwaukee at the extension operation, which caused a Regents investigation, which listed a 1,000-page report. And there were concerns then raised over counseling of a potential lesbian student in the Milwaukee system, as well as there was a controversy that arose with the firing of the dean of the extension system over in Milwaukee, who then charged that President Frank of the university and his backers in the Progressive Party were supporting immorality, including homosexual immorality, in that period. And the progressives and socialists in the state joined in the fight against that and beating back that attack.
Is that unique to Wisconsin history compared to other states who had similar things going on with Wisconsin's Progressive Party influence?
Right. This mini Lavender Scare in the 30s did not occur in many places. There was also, it was both a Lavender and Red Scare in the 30s, and there were very few of those around the country. And to align the forces of the Progressive Party and the Socialist out of Milwaukee against that showed that they had moved from where they were in the pre-World War period, where they were all against suppressing vice. And in this case, they were sort of fighting against the sort of Lavender Scare charges that had been raised, in this case by conservative Democrats.
How did you find that people within the university were resilient in finding ways to fight back against what was happening?
Well, the remarkable thing is that you have the predominant narrative from homophobia that homosexuals are criminals or they're sick. And the way to counteract that was to try and get their own voices heard. It's similar to the post-Stonewall coming out experience of where telling your own stories is a way to contradict the assumptions, wrongheaded assumptions about gays and lesbians. And so by gay people participating in these studies by UW academics, 30s and the 40s and into the 50s, they were trying to change the narrative by actually describing their own lives as not something quite so odd. And the other interesting thing was that in many of the comments, they would talk about not sex, but about love. And so that was also trying to change the definition, because the also other assumption and narrative was that, you know, homosexuals were all sex fiends, and of course heterosexuals were not sex fiends.
Right. I also want to bring attention to, you highlight a lot of people in your book. A couple on the front, Charlotte Partridge and Miriam Fink, have Milwaukee roots right here and founded Milwaukee's Layton School of the Arts. Could you describe to listeners a little bit of their story?
Sure. They met at Milwaukee Downer College, and female colleges were terrible breeding grounds for these sort of domestic friendships, which was the name for two women who would live together before lesbians became a popular name for that. And so they left their room at the college, which the college had provided them as part of their compensation, and moved off campus. And then they went on to found the Layton School for Arts in the basement of the Layton Galleries. They were very involved with the Work Progress Administration arts programs during the New Deal. And in fact, when Charlotte Partridge, who was more the artist of the group who had been running that, had to step down, her partner, Miriam Frink, stepped in for the while she was there. They were quite remarkable women. They were well known in Milwaukee's civic circles. They were on committees to honor Victor Berger's widow, Meta, who was very well known in the community as well. They built a house in suburban Thiensville and had a studio up on the north shore of Lake Michigan near Fox Point. And so here you had these two remarkable women leading their partnered lives together in the public sphere of Milwaukee. They also encouraged gay artists at the Layton School for the Arts. So they were a remarkable couple.
One thing I noticed going through the book is, of course, the different way that gay men were affected by the goings-ons of the time versus lesbians. What,
sure.
What are your observations on that? And well, is it the nature of history and the still yet limited roles women could play?
Yes, it was. Women's roles were circumscribed. And one of the conversations I had with one of the people who had reviewed the book was that women's sexuality was often discounted. And so, you know, men acting out sexually different was thought to be very dangerous, and women's sexuality was hardly noticed in so many ways back in those days. In fact, at one point, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled that sort of the old statute against sodomy or crime against nature couldn't be applied to women because there was no male organ involved. Later, the legislature corrected that to change it to sexual perversion, which included both sexes. But again, that was just another example of how female sexuality was given a lesser prominence. One of the other things is that the Dean of Women on the Madison campus at the time of the gay purge in 1962 was a lesbian, and she wasn't interested in purging women students who might have been accused of lesbianism, and in fact, the student discipline files don't show any of those kinds of cases. There were some 50 women who were disciplined for heterosexual violations, and another 50 men who were disciplined for homosexual violations, but no lesbian violations.
What do you think is one of the most valuable lessons readers can take away from learning about Wisconsin's early gay history?
One of it is the agency of gays and lesbians themselves in establishing their lives and in establishing places where they could live and beginning to tell their stories. In other words, and this is the first volume of two volumes, and the second volume tells the remarkable story of how that early impulse for liberation in Wisconsin is fully realized when we become the first state to pass a gay rights law.
Well, Dick Wegner, thank you so much for your extensive work on this book. It certainly offers a lot of great insights. And thank you so much for the time you took to speak with me about it today.
Glad to do it, Audrey.
Dick Wegner is the author of We've Been Here All Along, Wisconsin's Early Gay History. He first spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in September, and you can find more information about the book at WUWM.com. After a break, we'll learn about Milwaukee's Newhall House Fire, which remains one of the deadliest hotel fires in U.S. history. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. In the late 1800s, Milwaukee was a city defined by industry. Among other things, the city was the world's largest primary wheat market, which made it a hub of business. Like other wealthy Milwaukeeans, grain trader Daniel Newhall capitalized on the influx of people by creating a luxury hotel known as the Newhall House. At six stories, it was one of the largest buildings in the country when it was built in 1857. History remembers the Newhall House, not for its opulence, however, but for the gruesome event that transpired there one January night in 1883. At the time, the Newhall House fire was the deadliest in U.S. history, and although it lasted less than an hour, at least 75 people were killed. Author Matthew Prigge's book, Damn the Old Tinderbox, chronicles what happened at every step of the fire, how people survived, and how they perished. He stopped by the studio in March to speak with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and began by explaining what precautions were in place in the 1880s.
Fire safety at the time, just during the whole era of the Newhall House, was pretty primitive. The Newhall House, by the 1880s, had fire escapes, but there were no signs indicating to where the fire escapes were. There were fire hoses, but there was no regulation by the city that they be maintained in any way. The Newhall House had actually been inspected by an insurance adjuster just a month before the fire and didn't find anything that was overly alarming. And the Newhall House, by all city and state regulations, was perfectly up to code.
And yet it did seem like no one was surprised that there was a fire there. You know, you wrote about it in the book.
Right.
The fire department, and the title alludes to this, did think of the Newhall House as a sort of tinderbox, that a fire was going to happen there.
Well, there had been fires there in the past. No one had ever been injured or lost their lives. But fire at the time was sort of this omnipresent danger no matter where you were. I don't think that the Newhall House was any more safe or dangerous than other hotels in the city or most buildings where the public would have gathered. There was this odd sense at the time when I was researching this, both from the fire department and contemporary accounts and the accounts of the people who were in the house that night, that everybody was aware that this could happen and probably would happen, but still nobody really took the initiative to be proactive about minimizing the risk of catastrophic loss of life.
Well, and as you say, it did seem like it was a kind of omnipresent danger, as in a fire could happen kind of at any moment. And,
right.
And there had been fires, as you mentioned. What made this fire different from what had previously happened at the Newhall House?
For one thing, the fire happened very late at night. It was about 3 a.m. There were only three staff members on duty at that time. Everybody was asleep. So it was kind of an ideal time for a fire to take hold of the building. And even more impactful than that was where the fire started. It started at the base of the elevator shaft in the Newhall. Now, the Newhall, the elevator was installed in the 1870s, and the elevator shaft was wooden-lined. The elevators in those days at the top, they had they called a cap. It was essentially an open-air top to the elevator shaft with a little roof built over it. Also, it being in January, it was very cold outside. It was much warmer inside the house, so the air was being drawn up the elevator shaft toward the roof, and once the fire got going at the base of that, it was, I don't imagine you could have more perfectly designed a system to destroy this building than this elevator shaft that within a few minutes delivered the fire to every floor of the house and the roof. The elevator operator was the one who actually discovered the fire. He was coming down in the elevator and noticed the smoke coming up through the floor. By the time he had discovered it and jumped off the elevator and told the front desk clerk that there was a fire, it had probably already reached the roof.
You know, something the book focuses on is the many missteps that happened at the beginning of the fire and then throughout as it was starting to spread. Mm-hmm. What were those initial missteps?
Well, the standing orders at the hotel, whether quasi-official orders from management, were in the event of a fire to first try to fight the fire in-house. You know, the more callous view of this is that they didn't want to wake up any guests or tarnish their reputation at all, which was, I believe, part of it. But also, there's a more practical means to this, to try to, you know, if you see a fire, to try to put it out as soon as you can. But again, with just how the fire had started and how it was discovered, by the time, and we're talking just in the span of a few minutes here, but by the time the two staff members had gone into the basement to try to assess the situation, it was already well beyond control. I don't think that anything really could have been done to put the fire out once it had been discovered. But the key thing that went wrong with two of the three people who were on duty that night was they didn't wake up any of the guests. One went to wake up the proprietor of the hotel, who actually lived in one of the hotel's rooms, but not in the building proper. It had expanded into the next door building. The boiler operator actually went up to the fifth floor to try to wake up the women who lived there, the domestic workers. And the third guy called the fire department and just sort of waited around for them to show up. So one of the things I keep coming back to in the action of this, in the narrative of the book, is, you know, using timestamps to, you know, 15 minutes since they discovered it. And deep into the situation here, no one had made an attempt to wake up any of the guests. Pretty much all of them woke up either to the noise of the confusion in the hallways or the smell of smoke or the glass transoms above their doors shattering from the heat.
And as you mentioned in the book, there was, in fact, a very famous guest, a man who was very famous at the time, known as General Tom Thumb from P.T. Barnum's Circus.
Correct. The hotel seemed to be favored by traveling theater companies. So there are a few different theater companies staying there, and among them was the Tom Thumb Show. General Tom Thumb was a little person. At the time, he was kind of at the tail end of his career. He had been, a few decades earlier, probably among the more famous people on Earth.
Well, this was a man who had met with the King and Queen of England, the President of the United States.
Yeah. He was very well known, one of the first celebrities, if you will. And he traveled with a group of performers and also with some very valuable diamonds and coins, which were lost in the fire. And he was afterwards quite adamant about the police trying to locate his missing coin collection.
But he and his wife, and most of his troop, it seems, were able to escape the fire.
Yeah, he survived by being—well, his room had the very good fortune of actually having a small balcony that would have overlooked—would have been on Michigan Street, basically, if you're familiar with the Chamber of Commerce building there and the Mitchell building and the Swingin' Door Tavern right there on that street. That would have been overlooking out at that part of Michigan Street. So his escape was among the more simple of everyone who got out that night. They had a ladder up to his balcony, and he climbed down, and then a police officer carried his wife right after him.
Which was lucky for them. How did most of the guests escape?
Most of the guests who escaped did so through the hallways. How I ended up structuring the narrative in the book was just kind of started at the lower floors and went upward. Because in researching all this, basically the higher up you were in the hotel, the less your chances were of surviving. Most of the people on the main floor, the second floor of the building, which was the first floor of the hotel, the actual ground floor had offices and shops and things like that. But the people who were staying on the second floor, pretty much all of them woke up to smoke or noise and made their way out through the hallways. But if you were staying on the third floor or higher, you probably had a pretty rough go of it trying to get out, because by the time you woke up, the hallways were very hot, very filled with smoke. And we're not talking about a complicated building that's got a very complicated layout here. There were two huge stairways. All the hallways were straight shots that could either go right to the stairway or go around a corner and you were at the stairway. But people got out there and they got very disoriented. Survivors talked about running around inside the hotel for what seemed like 5 or 10 minutes trying to, and then ending up just tumbling down the stairs or running into someone else who dragged them out. The people who couldn't make it out into the hallways, they were mostly forced back to the windows in their rooms. And the fire department's life-saving mechanisms back then were pretty rustic, and it was not a sure thing that even if you could get to your window and, you know, see the rescue ladders being raised, that they're going to be able to get to you.
They did have some issues with the rescue ladders, and it raised a larger question. As this fire is going on, what were the mechanisms that a fire department more generally could use to combat a fire at this time?
By the time the fire department got there, again, I talked about how quickly the fire took hold of the building. They had pretty much abandoned hope of doing anything from inside. So they were out on the sidewalks, sending water into the windows to try to, really by that point, just to try to make it as easy for people to escape if they still could. But because by that time, it was pretty much a given that the building was going to be a loss. The ladders they had were of limited use, given the design of the building and just the realities of the fire department's staffing situation. Actually, the ladders that they had that had the highest reach, I think they took 6 men to operate, and this was above the means of most fire companies. So they had these two large cranks to extend the ladder to these windows, and they actually had to grab people off the street to help operate this fire department machinery that the fire department didn't have enough people to operate. Shorter ladders, they had trouble with the telegraph cables that were you know, if you can imagine where they, like the power lines would be today. The Newhall House being what it was kind of a communications hub for the area with a lot of business people staying there. So there are these huge sets of telegraph cables surrounding the building coming up off the sidewalk. So they had to maneuver these ladders around these cables. This is the way the building was designed. Its elaborate design made it difficult to get the ladders flush up against the side of the building. They could really only reach the third and fourth floors with these ladders just because of the way everything was designed. And this is also a very slow-moving process, having to manually move these ladders from window to window. And during this process, which again was the whole hotel was ruined in about 40 minutes, a lot of people waiting in their windows chose to jump. And the fire department did have jumping sheets. If you, I always think of it from old cartoons when they hold out that thing and somebody tries to jump into it. But the reality of those was pretty gruesome as well. They needed like 20 people to hold one of these taut to actually support the weight of somebody leaping from a great height into it. And again, they're very understaffed, so they have not enough people holding these things. People jumped towards these sheets and either missed them or, you know, went right through the middle because there wasn't enough people holding it. So if you ended up on the windows, it was your chances of survival were not great.
So in total, how many people died in this fire?
Using the missing persons, the known persons lost, and then the rather gruesome business of removing the bodies of the people who didn't escape after the hotel was ruined, I've come to 75, and I think that's a pretty solid estimate.
What was the aftermath like here in Milwaukee and, you know, throughout the country in some ways?
Well, the immediate aftermath was, I mean, this was international news after it happened. It was the deadliest hotel fire at the time up until 1947. And again, still one of the deadliest hotel fires ever. So the immediate aftermath was one of, you know, a lot of shock, a lot of sorrow. There was some call for reform after this, but it didn't really go anywhere. And that was one of the interesting things I found out when I was doing all this research, was that despite all the very obvious flaws in the systems within the system of the fire department, of city regulations, of building codes, not much was done to prevent this from happening again. In fact, later in 1883, there was a fire at the Plankinton House Hotel, which by the 1880s had overtaken the Newhall as the, you know, the premier hotel in Milwaukee. And, you know, despite all of the, from the newspapers, all the condemnation of, you know, the people who ran the house, saying it was unsafe, and so on and so forth, the fire at the Plankinton was started by a steam pipe that was sitting on a wooden bracket, ignited the fire in the basement. One of the same flaws that were found at the Newhall House. But the fire at the Plankinton, it happened during the dinner hour. Everybody was awake. They got to it quite early. There was a brief panic. Everybody, you know, ran out into the streets. But the fire department was able to get there and put it down and without any major injury. And even after that, the fire department kind of readily admitted that, you know, if this had happened at 3 a.m., we probably would have had another Newhall House fire situation. And even after that, like, really nothing happened. Not nationally, not even locally. It really wasn't until the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in New York City that real fire safety regulation began to reform, began to take hold. And that was 40-some years later.
Matthew Prigge is a Milwaukee-based writer and the author of Damn the Old Tinderbox, Milwaukee's Palace of the West, and the Fire That Defined an Era. He first spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in March. We'll take one last break, and then Milwaukee author Christina Ward takes us on a 20th century culinary journey. We'll learn more when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Have you ever wondered why such a thing as a gingered pear and chicken salad served in lime jello exists? Well, what about baked bananas rolled in ham served with a cheese sauce? Or anything at all made with Spam, or even just Spam itself? The foods and recipes that many of us grew up with were thanks to American corporations and their advertising departments. Not only were the corporations promoting the products they were selling, they were also promoting what it meant to be an American. Christina Ward's newest book, American Advertising Cookbooks, looks at how things like Jell-O, bananas, and Spam became household staples, and it's a fascinating story. She joined me in the studio in February to explain that this book came out of her first one, Preservation, The Art and Science of Canning, Fermentation, and Dehydration.
In doing all my research about the history of food preservation, it became really, really clear that food preservation in and of itself was such a cataclysmic event in culinary history. And then when you look, start peeling that back and looking closer, the ability to keep food longer than a few days changed how we're going to eat, because then it enabled just your small farmer to have a few more days, and then he could take it to market. And then those market folks then became processors, as they would make things out of it. And then it just, the business expanded. I mean, if you think about Hellman's mayonnaise was started by Richard Hellman in, I think, 1910. And he owned a small deli in New York City. And he and his wife made their recipe mayonnaise in the back of the shop and sold it out of the shop. And because of the technology of being able to preserve things and then start marketing and the distribution, within 3-4 years, he was nationwide.
And you think, yes, we are a business-oriented culture. You know, Americans are very good about the bootstrap thing and the entrepreneur thing and making stuff to sell. Corporations somehow took over.
They did. And it, I think that there's a myth that this rise of corporations is, you know, something of a recent of memory. It's not. So even with the example of Hellman's, they started, and by the 1920s, in the span of 10 years, they were bought out by another company that eventually became General Foods. So,
although they kept the name Hellman's.
They did keep the Hellman's as a brand, and that's one of the things that's really interesting, is that a lot of the foods that we're familiar with today that we think are just freestanding things are just brand names, and they're owned by a larger corporate entity. And that's started right in the 1910s. This is coming out of the kind of that gilded age of the corporate robber barons. And so there was almost like an American mania for building the biggest company you possibly could. And the laws at the time kind of helped that along. What we think of as like some of the anti-monopoly laws didn't really come in till after the 1920s. And since they were enacted in the 20s, they've been kind of peeled back, you know, a little bit at a time until now, where, again, we're in a position where a lot of what they call holding companies are owning a diversified portfolio of actual companies. So you've got food manufacturers that are also cigarette manufacturers and sellers. And so it's an interesting food landscape.
Well, and as you say, it started 100 years ago, really,
it
in
did,
this country.
Yeah.
And so it seems to me that we have somehow maybe tried to reverse that a little bit in the last decade or so, where, you know, we're interested in going to farmers markets and buying somebody's local preserves, or we're interested in finding out who actually owns the companies that produce the food that we eat.
And I think it's the arc. I'm a fan of pure science, but I'm also cautious about applied science, because sometimes the applied sciences are applied by corporations, and that's the unintended consequences. And I think we have to remember culturally, we're not too far away from actual starvation, where people did starve, where, you know, if you didn't know where your next meal was coming from the next few days, you were really in trouble. And so that ability to preserve food and then fortify it and inoculate it with antibacterials and vitamins and, you know, make it more than what it actually is, when it first started in the 20s and 30s and 40s, it really served a great purpose and helped people. But the unintended consequences, of course, are the increased amounts of salts and sugars that have added to the obesity crisis in the United States. So that helped trigger that kind of the consciousness about, like, what are we really eating here? And do we really want to eat this?
Did it also affect the idea of sort of corporate agriculture, where we have monocrops because we have to support the kind of processing that you're describing here?
Absolutely. That's the story of bananas. Bananas are a monocrop. They are asexual reproducers, which means, like a tuber, like when you're planting tulips, you have to put the thing in the ground to get the thing to fruit. And by doing that with one variety over time through Central America, that decimated the local kind of flora and agriculture systems. Not to mention, because something like a banana, which has really only a few natural predators and doesn't really evolve in its DNA, is very susceptible to things like a root rot or a leaf rot. And so Central America itself has been poisoned over the past 70 years by pesticides. And so again, it's unintended consequences. We want bananas. We like bananas. But now bananas are actually on the verge of extinction because the predatory viruses and blights that have been evolving to eat those bananas are winning. So right now, and again, this is kind of the interesting thing with the science of bananas, and it's happening, as you said, with a lot of other crops too, is how do we protect from vermin and with pesticides? And so that next phase is now you're seeing a lot of what they call genetically modified, where much of the wheat crop and corn crops and soy crops in the United States are actually modified that have the pesticide adjusted in the actual seed. And so the plant itself is resistant to any type of blight.
So how did we learn to love Spam, which is one of the things you mention?
The story of Spam is so interesting. Again, it comes out of food preservation. In 1906, there was a law finally passed called the Food and Drug Act. And it was the first time in the United States that we had any kind of national rules about what actually was food. And it actually published a book called The Formulary, and it defined every kind of food and what was in it, what it could contain. And before that, there were a lot of food scares, contaminated foods and things passed off as food that wasn't. And so the idea of a spam, which is a pork byproduct, mostly fat with a lot of salt, prior to the development in World War I, would have never passed muster with the United States because the consumer was afraid of any kind of adulterated foods. But through really good marketing, which was the idea of saying, this is for the country, this is healthy, it's fortified, it's got vitamins, it's inexpensive, and so you should eat it. You know, you're doing your part for the war efforts by giving it to your friends and family. And so it was also served as a military ration. And so post-World War II then, as many soldiers came home, they developed a taste for that salty, porky fat, which, you know, fry it up. It's kind of delicious in a terrible way. And so the marketing then changed to say, you know, reward your hardworking men with, you know, Spam. And that's really how they taught us to love that taste.
Well, and it sounds like it's both, and I hesitate to use the word collusion because maybe that's too strong a word for it, but between corporations and the government, if it's like for the war effort.
Oh, there's collusion.
Okay, so it's not too strong a word.
Oh, it is not too strong a word at all, because one of the pioneers of food advertising was Edward Bernays. Edward Bernays, who's the nephew of Sigmund Freud, who was trained in the early psychoanalytic techniques and understanding of human psychology, his first job before he went into advertising was working for the Committee for the Public Interest, which was a precursor to the CIA and was in charge of propaganda during World War I and up until the early 1930s. So there's a definite relationship between governments and advertising and corporations. Funnily enough, I mean, it comes to his partners he was working with at the CPI were the Dulles brothers, the infamous Dulles brothers, who one headed up the CIA and then one worked for John Kennedy.
And had an airport named after him.
And has an airport named after him. So again, and this also, I think, tells the story. It's a smallness. And I think, you know, part of that, we forget. We think we're a big country, but we find it here in Milwaukee, kind of that joke of small walkie. When you're working in the elite, the corporations, we're looking at some of the early founding families, Everybody knew everybody. So it wasn't necessarily a malicious collusion, but it was a friendly collusion of like, this is the guy you went to Harvard with. This is the guy you served in the early propaganda outfit with. And they all helped each other.
Before we turned on the microphones, we were talking about how this is about way more than food. It's about culture and defining culture and what is acceptable and what isn't through the advertising, through the kind of foods that you were told to eat or encouraged to eat. And, you know, it had even involved gender norms.
Absolutely. And this is where I think that I wanted to tell this story, because it was that one time that I could pinpoint in the kind of American history of when we really became Americans. And it was that idea of the communications, printing presses became cheap. The food became cheaper. Travel, railroads opened up the country to the expansion, immigrants coming in. So we had all these different influences and then people trying to control those outcomes and then having the tools to do it. So when you talk about like the idea of food from our early Puritan founders, they had very distinct ideas about what food was proper. I mean, if you're looking at early Protestant food cookbooks, there's no spices for a number of reasons. And that through line, through those families and through those generations, the traditions held true. So, you know, we're still in the 1930s and 40s and covering everything in white sauce, which is, you know, not a bechamel. It's just flour and a little milk. It's not really, it's more like paste. But the idea was, is to keep everything packed full of calories, because you needed it if you're going to work in a factory or a farm, and keep everybody eating in a very similar way, because you didn't want things that would be too exciting or too outside what the norm was. And so that's where you get like the great Born in Milwaukee, the Settlement Cookbook, which was founded by earlier settler German Jews. And as that second wave of Jewish immigration came to Milwaukee, which were mostly Eastern European and Ashkenazi Jews, who had a totally different type of outlook on food and cooking. And, you know, the high-born, very elite German Jews wanted to teach the newcomers, this is how you're American. You cook like us. And that became like a real through line through a lot of the immigrant groups had different settlement houses that were usually funded by the wives of the manufacturer factory owners here in Milwaukee. And they each had a way to help teach the kids, teach everybody, again, how to be American. And being American meant being more Protestant, more conservative, and, you know, less fun, really.
No spices.
No spices.
Where do you see this kind of influence happening now? Do we have the same sort of need to look to corporations to tell us how to eat like an American?
I think we're more savvy to advertisers, but we're not immune. I think where you see a lot of it more is with cooking shows and, you know, this is just a theory because of how we, you know, ate a lot of boxed canned foods growing up for a certain period of time, is that a lot of our food marketing is aspirational. And so what you'll see a lot of is the food, the kits, I think, are really an interesting phenomenon. So when you see those pre-made food kits, or you can order online or they have delivered, it's essentially buying food in a box. The same thing it was, you know, 50 years ago. But they've kind of zhuzhed up the marketing, and you see happy people with their families and the time. And it has this really wonderful aspirational aspect to it. And I think that's where the marketing is going right now. And I think we should also be cautious of it, because the negative connotations, again, are describing who gets to be an American. So you see these like beautiful, thin people making their dinners, and they're all in these very upper middle class houses. And so we have to be really careful, again, about the messages of class and gender, and, you know, how we judge people who are eating what kind of food.
Well, and those meal kits that you're talking about, the food may come in a box, but it aspires to be fresh.
Exactly. There's still some level of preservation and artificiality going on with those.
Has to be.
It has to be.
Yeah. How is it going to come to your house in a box? and not be rotten.
Right. And fundamentally, it's still, you know, I find it really interesting because just like the reading the box of macaroni and cheese where it's like, you know, boil noodles, add the things, those meal kits with that idea of aspirational freshness are still like you follow just the instructions. Don't you're not actually cooking. You're just following instructions. And that is, I think, one of the consequences of this time period in advertising cooking. It kind of took away the ability to cook. There's a whole multiple generations of folks who don't really know how to cook things anymore. I'm pro bringing back some home economics education for kids.
I completely agree. And in Europe, they still do.
Oh.
And it's both genders. It's not assumed that it's just girls.
What's interesting when you say Europe, too, is the Europeans, of course, there's processed food in Europe, but there's less effect, overall effect, than here in the United States. The corporate hold on the American food systems was so pervasive throughout the entire food system, say from like the 20s through the 70s, even now, that it was able to really shape, how we eat overall, and less so in Europe. So again, they're still fighting some of the obesity crisis that come from processed foods. But not to the extent that we are here in the United States.
It's true. I mean, for example, when I was in Germany, I heard a lot from my German colleagues about how Americans have ammonia chicken and they don't want it. They won't eat it because it's processed with ammonia to probably kill whatever it's going to, you know.
Extends and, the life.
Yeah. And they just will not have it.
And I think, and that's where more Americans need to, and again, there's so many different influences to find that balance. If you're going to Outpost to buy pure natural chicken or to Whole Foods, you're charged a premium for that. And so in the United States, freshness is at an expense. So if you're not in a financial position to spend, you know, X amount per week on your food budgets, your choices are quite limited. And again, that's a product of the American corporations, that they can pull the nutrient levels down, they can mass package things, and you can get the caloric intake up and the nutrient levels just about barely acceptable and make it cheap enough that poor people can eat it.
Right. That's, and I was going to say, there's the word cheap enough.
Right.
Because if nothing, you know, we look for bargains in this country. That's a cultural thing, is that we all want a bargain.
We do want a bargain. And I think, and that's a great disconnect. And you and I were talking earlier, I think the difference, and that's, you know, part of what an American is seeing the cost without seeing the value. And so I think we need to find more value and worry about cost a little differently.
Well, Christina Ward, it is always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Milwaukee author Christina Ward's newest book is called American Advertising Cookbooks: How Corporations Taught Us to Love Spam, Bananas, and Jell-O. We first spoke with her in February. And that wraps up our Best of Wisconsin Authors edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. It's been great having you with us today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It is 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.